What's the witness after your next witness? How long is that?
That's a long one, probably about 40 minutes. 35-40.
Well, let me think about this. We might as well break for lunch. I don't want to hold people here. We could be going quite a while. Let's be in order, please. Where is the commission's lawyer? Ah, he's coming. I was worried you were looking for your watch. Ms. Smith, you may proceed.
I would call Mike Hennis.
Mr. Hennis, as you heard me advise previous witnesses, your testimony is required to be under oath, and I'm required by law to advise you regarding perjury for administering the oath. Perjury is a false statement of material fact which you do not believe to be true. In North Dakota, perjury is a Class C felony, punishable by a fine up to $5,000, imprisonment for a period of up to 5 years or both. You raise your right hand, please. Being advised regarding perjury, Mr. Hennis, do you swear that the testimony which you're about to give in this matter shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
I do.
Ms. Smith.
Could you please state your full name?
Michael Hennis.
And by whom are you employed?
Minnkota Power Cooperative.
And so you are also at the same address as Mr. Shapin?
Yes, that's correct.
And what is your position with Minnkota?
I am the systems project manager.
And could you briefly discuss your education and work history?
Yes, I have a Bachelor of Science degrees in Electrical Engineering and Engineering Management from the University of North Dakota. I began my career with Basin Electric in 1975. I spent 10 years with the University of North Dakota involved in atmospheric science research efforts, and then I rejoined the power industry with Minnkota Power in 1994 as an electrical engineer. I also served as a project engineer and an engineering manager.
And what is your role with respect to the project?
I am been assigned the overall project manager for the Senator Grand Forks project.
And what are your responsibilities as project manager?
I have the responsibility for budgeting, scheduling, coordination of the permitting, the design, right-of-way acquisition, and also the construction of the proposed project.
And could you please tell the commission about the various people or groups of people that are assisting with the project?
Certainly. Minnkota has assigned team leads in various areas. We've assigned team leads in engineering, environmental permitting, right-of-way and legal, procurement, communications and public relations, and also in construction management. And for this project, we also have working with outside consultants. We've assigned Stanley Consultants as a prime consultant responsible for project design and construction, construction management, and also Cattermas, Lee and Jackson and KBM, two local consulting firms who are responsible for the survey and right-of-way acquisition work. We've also retained the services of HDR engineers, and they are responsible for the overall environmental and permitting for this project.
And why is it that Minnkota is using outside personnel to assist with the project?
Well, this is normal practice for a project of this size. It's kind of impractical for a company our size to staff up for this larger project. Our typical construction budget is in the order of $5 to $10 million per year, and this one project is certainly a $300 million project.
If you could turn in the exhibit book to what's been previously marked as Exhibit 3. Actually, sorry, it's the big binder.
Right.
Do you recognize that
yes.
Document? Could you tell us what it is?
It's a copy of the Minn Kota Certificate of Corridor Application for this project that was filed with the Commission on February 18th, 2011. We have submitted supplemental information that was filed as late as June 9th, 2011, and that's included in this exhibit.
And was this application prepared under your supervision and control?
Yes, that's correct.
I would offer Exhibit 3.
Mr. Sagsveen.
No objections.
Exhibit 3 is received.
Could you please provide the Commission with a basic description of the project?
Yes, this project is approximately 250 miles long. It is a 345 kV transmission line that originates in Center, North Dakota, and terminates in Grand Forks, North Dakota. The overall project will also require modifications of existing substations at Center and at Square Butte, which is near the Center substation, and also at Prairie substation, which is on the western edge of Grand Forks. We will also require fiber optic regeneration stations along the route. Approximately four of these stations will be required. And we also include construction of a new 230 kV tie line between the Square Butte and Center to handle the additional output of Young 2 into the 345 kV system. We'll also be relocating existing transmission line structures at the Center 345 kV and Prairie substations. And the total project cost estimate for this project is $312 million.
And will the project be owned and operated by Minn Kota Power Cooperative, Inc.?
Yes.
What is Minn Kota's anticipated schedule for the project?
Well, this project was started back in 2009 on a four-year timeline. We are seeing some delays in the permitting process, both the federal and the state, so we're now projecting a five-year schedule. With anticipated PSC approval of the corridor and the route permit yet this fall of 2011, that would allow us a limited start of construction again the fall of 2011, and that would put us with an in-service date of third quarter 2013.
And can you explain to the Commission why you are allowing approximately 2 years for construction of the project?
With construction progress estimated at approximately 8 miles a week, or about 40 foundations or 40 towers to install, this schedule does allow for downtime in the heart of winter and also when road restrictions are in place in the spring. So this will help us minimize road damage and soil compaction during construction.
You testified that as project manager, you are involved in the permitting and design of the proposed project. Is that correct?
Yes.
So as part of that permitting and design work, have you also been involved in the siting process for the project, including the selection of the proposed project corridor?
Yes, I've been involved in all aspects of the siting process as well.
Could you provide the Commission with an overview of the siting process for the project?
Well, the siting process for this project involves a four-step approach. And, step one and two are part of a federal review process, and steps three and four are part of the state permitting process that we're beginning here today. I will use exhibits to explain these steps in more detail in just a few minutes.
And why is the project undergoing a federal review?
Well, as Minn Kota is requesting project funding from the U.S. Department of Agricultural Rural Utility Service, or I'll refer to it as the RUS, to construct this project, a federal review process is required for loan approval. This process includes complying with the National Environmental Policy Act, or NEPA.
And if you'll look then in the exhibit book at exhibits 4 through 8, and exhibits 4 through 8 are also on the board to the side of you, do you recognize those exhibits?
Yes, I do.
Could you tell us what they are?
Exhibit 4 shows the preliminary study corridors that we used at the beginning of the process. Exhibit 5 is the refinement to the macro corridors, and Exhibit 6 is the route segments that were ultimately analyzed within that overall corridor. And Route 7 shows alternatives that were reviewed in the environmental assessment with scoping process. And Exhibit 8 shows the proposed corridor, which is the subject of today's hearing.
And were Exhibits 4 through 8 prepared under your supervision and control?
Yes.
And will Exhibits 4 through 8 assist you with your testimony regarding the citing process?
Yes.
I would offer Exhibits 4 through 8.
Mr. Sagsby.
No objections.
Exhibits 4 through 8 inclusive are each received.
Before we discuss the corridor selection process, could you explain how the terms corridor and route are used in Exhibits 4 through 8?
Generally, the term corridor implies a wider study area, while the term route implies one or more narrow paths considered within that for the proposed transmission line. Also, for example, on the Senator Grand Forks project in the federal process, Minn Kota first identified a 6 mile wide study corridor and then selected 3 1,000 foot wide routes within that corridor for detailed analysis. For the state process, Minn Kota started with the identified preferred route from the federal process and renamed it the project corridor. The project corridor will then be further analyzed in order to select the ultimate 150-foot-wide right-of-way that will be the basis for the project's route permit application. So again, the corridor is a wider study area, and a route is a narrower study area within that corridor.
And how has the federal review process played a role in developing the corridor that is the subject of today's hearing?
Well, Exhibits 4 through 8 help demonstrate this methodical narrowing process that took the project from a 6 mile wide study corridor to the 1,000 foot wide corridor we have today. This corresponds with the four-step approach to the siting mentioned earlier. Steps 1 and 2, which are part of the federal review process, are shown in Exhibits 4 through 7.
And could you describe for the Commission step 1 of the siting process?
Yes, step 1 was to prepare the alternative evaluation study, which was the basis for earlier testimony by Mr. Chapin and Mr. Bartel. This study identified the need for the project and reviewed the alternatives that were considered. The macro corridor study was also prepared at this time that identified the high-level environmental considerations in that 6 mile wide corridor that would be common to any of the proposed routes required to build this project. If we look at Exhibit 4, it does...
You might have to just pull it towards you,
yeah.
I think.
Let's see if this works here. If we look at Exhibit 4, I can find my red dot. There we go. We do see those transmission corridors along the I-95 corridor that Mr. Bartel recognized, and it also identifies one northern transmission along the route, and one other transmission in the northern valley is through that diagonal corridor. So this, it does help us understand the logic of looking for the maximum geographic separation from this route with the others to provide that maximum reliability benefit for siting this new transmission line. The other thing I'd like to point out is the constraints and challenges that were in this area. We see a large amount of wetlands and potholes and challenges in both engineering, you know, and environmental for that southern corridor. So that was taken into consideration, but you can also see the large amount of what we call avoidance areas, wildlife protection areas that the route also had to navigate. So this exhibit tells us where our starting point was in the process to define a macro corridor for further review.
And what is depicted then in Exhibit 5?
Exhibit 5 shows this refinement, and it does also shows that we did eliminate two corridors from further study. This was based on public input, looking at the more northern Missouri River crossing. We did get quite a bit of agency and public input, concerns about crossing near the Cross Ranch recreation and game preserves area in that area. And also the public had concerns about creating another transmission corridor for the transmission line. So they encouraged us to look at a more southern crossing that was in vicinity of two existing transmission lines crossing the Missouri River. So ultimately, we eliminated that northern crossing and chose a more southern crossing that was in between two existing transmission lines. And again, that southern corridor that showed grade out there was eliminated because of the high impact of the number of wetlands in that area.
And what was step two of the siting process?
Step two of the siting process was to prepare the environmental assessment with scoping report. The purpose of the environmental assessment is to identify a routing alternatives within the study corridor and evaluate those alternatives to identify the route with the least overall impact to the entire 250-mile project. Exhibit 6 then shows the approximately 191 routing segments that were reviewed within that macro corridor study area. These routing segments were analyzed for impact, and statistics were taken, including the percentage of cropland versus prairie land, the amount of woodlands impacted, you know, proximity to airports, proximity to homes and farms. So those segments were then screened down to 3 proposed routes, which is shown in Exhibit 7.
How did Minn Kota select the 1,000-foot-wide corridor that is the subject of today's hearing?
Well, step 3 of this 4-step process was to identify a corridor in which a transmission line route that will meet the North Dakota PSC siting criteria can be located. The preferred 1,000-foot route identified in an environmental assessment process most fully meets this criteria. This route that has now been further refined with additional landowner input between the environmental assessment comment period and our filing. And this new result then is a 1,000-foot wide corridor presented in our corridor application and shown in Exhibit 8.
And what will step 4 of the process be?
Step 4 of this process will be to identify the final alignment for the 150-foot wide right-of-way within this 1,000-foot corridor. And that will be submitted in our route permit application.
And if you would turn to Exhibit 9 in the exhibit book, and that will also be placed on a board as well. So we'll just take a second to put that up. Do you recognize Exhibit 9?
Yes.
And could you identify it for us?
Exhibit 9 provides an overview of the state and federal permitting processes with the public involvement opportunities also identified.
And was Exhibit 9 prepared under your supervision and control?
Yes.
And will it assist you with your testimony here regarding the corridor siting process?
Yes.
I would offer Exhibit 9.
Mr. Sagsveen.
No objections.
Exhibit 9 is received.
Referring to Exhibit 9, could you describe for the Commission the public involvement opportunities that have been or will be provided during the siting process for this project?
Yes, the public involvement and input has been a key priority for Minn Kota from the very beginning of the project. We use this process to ensure an open and accessible corridor development and route siting. The Exhibit 9 is a very busy schedule, and I'll walk through some of the detail. But it's basically a timeline of opportunities for public input and also identifies the key milestones for both the federal and state process. So the timeline runs from the top of the graph to the bottom of the graph chronologically. So Exhibit 9 provides this overview, and yellow indicates Minn Kota's sponsored outreach efforts, our early efforts to identify the public, the route and our route criteria used and to gather public input for helping us identify additional input for the map that wasn't originally on our maps. And this may include private cemeteries and airports and those types of things. Blue indicates the public input opportunities during the federal review process, and those would be our U.S.-sponsored public input opportunities. And the green indicates the public opportunities that have occurred or will occur during the state process. Minn Kota, through these outgoing on-reach efforts, have had nearly 20 public meetings since early 2009. And over 850 people have attended these meetings, and we have received well over 300 comments, and which were addressed throughout these processes. Most recently, numerous local public meetings are also held for the conditional use permits required for the project, and they're being held at the township and county levels. As a result of these efforts, substantial public and stakeholder input has been collected and considered in developing the corridor. Other key outreach tools that we've used on the project include a project website, a toll-free number, quarterly newsletters that we're mailing to landowners along the project corridor, fact sheets, frequently asked questions, and a stakeholder database to track all the questions that do come into the project. We have a commitment to ongoing communications and outreach, and this will continue through our construction process.
And how did the public involvement opportunities that are depicted in Exhibit 9 correspond with the corridor selection process that you previously described?
Well, the preliminary study corridors shown in Exhibit 4 were first introduced to the public at Minn Kota-sponsored meetings in the spring of 2009. The refined macro corridor shown in Exhibit 5 was then introduced at the RUS scoping meeting in the fall of 2009. And the route segments and route segment alternatives, which were analyzed in environmental assessment, are shown in Exhibits 6 and 7. These were first presented at Minn Kota-sponsored public open house meetings in the spring of 2010. The proposed corridor, as shown in Exhibit 8, was then introduced during the winter of 2010 and 2011 as the preferred route identified in the environmental assessment. It was then publicized in the project newsletters, on the website, and in the corridor application. Mr. Phillips will give later testimony and will discuss this proposed corridor in detail in his testimony.
And why is Minn Kota requesting approval of a 1,000-foot wide corridor for the project?
By selecting the preferred route from the environmental assessment as the corridor for the corridor application, we can demonstrate that the proposed corridor has the least overall impact within the wider study area. A selection of a 1,000-foot wide project corridor is the result of an extensive pre-application routing process, and it provides the best opportunity for a more detailed analysis during this state review. The macro corridor to environmental assessment process involved in-depth environmental analysis and multiple opportunities for agency, tribal, and governmental review and public input. The 1,000-foot wide project corridor is the same width utilized in the environmental analysis study. So using a 6-mile wide corridor for the state process at this time, in my opinion, would be a step backwards. And it would not address the most asked question that we heard in our early public meetings was, where exactly are you proposing to put this line? As such, a narrow corridor provides an opportunity for more meaningful public input. A narrower corridor also minimizes the possibility of corridor being utilized for other projects after this project's approval. And it also is consistent with the recommendations of the commission in its letter response to Minn Kota when we requested routing guidance.
And what were some of the factors that Minn Kota took into account in developing the proposed project?
The two primary factors that we considered were the location of our project to occupied residences and farmsteads, and we also strove to minimize impact to tillable croplands.
And are there other factors as well that were studied?
The other factors that we evaluated in the corridor selection process include avoiding irrigated cropland, rural airports and airstrips, avoiding identified recreational, historical, archaeological, and culturally significant areas whenever possible. We also strove to avoid potential disturbances to rare and endangered species of plants and animals. The project also chose the selection process included minimizing impacts to shelter belts, wooded areas, and other areas of conservation and ecological importance, which strove to minimize effects on designated waterfall production areas, game management areas, and wildlife refuges. We also strove to minimize interference with extraction economic minerals and engineering, construction, and maintenance hazards. Other considerations were coordinating planning with existing wind easements, following existing rights-of-way, survey lines, and natural division lines, and agricultural field boundaries when feasible. Also, enhancing the grid reliability was a major concern, and also adhering to North Dakota Public Service Commission exclusion area and avoidance areas.
Earlier, I believe you testified that as project manager, you oversee right-of-way acquisition. Is that right?
Yes.
And what steps is Minn Kota taking to acquire right-of-way for the proposed project?
Minn Kota is currently seeking a right-of-way options with landowners.
And you mentioned an option. Then what is the difference between an option and an easement?
The option is an agreement with the landowner for a future right to acquire an easement. The right to acquire the easement must be exercised within a specified time. An easement is the right granted by the landowner to use a specific piece of property for a specific use for the specified length of time.
And why is Minn Kota acquiring easement options rather than easements?
Acquiring options at this time allows Minn Kota to begin the right-of-way acquisition process at the same time it pursues the required permits. But this also limits Minn Kota's financial investment in case the permitting process necessitates a change in the right-of-way location. A 500-foot wide option that we've been requiring gives the landowner and right-of-way agent some flexibility in working with the design team for the final location of the 150-foot wide permanent easement.
And are the easements that will be obtained for the project limited to a specific purpose?
Yes, the easements allow Minn Kota Cooperative to only install and maintain a single transmission system, and no other purpose are included or allowed within that easement.
And how were easement payments determined?
The project did some analysis and came up with a land basis value for each county. This was calculated by compiling and comparing our recent sales records for each county and also reviewing the USDA National Agricultural Statistics Service data compiled by county as well. In this, we considered the impacts from similar projects within the area. And compensation then is provided to the landowner in a combination of this land basis value payment for the overall area of the overhead easement, and we're also considering a per structure payment. This compensation takes into account the current land usage, the local market value of the land, and the calculated acreage required for the right-of-way. The per pole payments that we're also making take into consideration the effects on farming practices.
And why aren't annual payments, such as those that are provided for wind turbines, being offered to landowners as part of this project?
We feel that these situations are quite different. In the case of wind farms, the developers and landowners are harvesting a natural resource, in this case wind, that does produce a profit-generating revenue stream. This is not the case with the transmission easement. As a rural electric cooperative, our rates are based on the actual cost to deliver the electricity. We are not a profit-driven enterprise. While we take very seriously our obligation to provide fair compensation to landowners for easements, we also have an obligation to ratepayers to keep electricity rates affordable. This means keeping our project development costs as reasonable as possible. It's important to note that no other transmission utility provider in the region make long-term yearly payments for transmission easements. And also, we'd like to note that having a transmission easement that can coexist very well with end easements, we just require that there be a safe setback from the wind turbine from the transmission line.
And what activities will be restricted along the easements?
We restrict placing permanent structures under the power lines, planting of large growing trees, stockpiling materials under the line, or any activity that creates a safety hazard for the operation of the line.
And what impact to land use will the new transmission line have?
Well, we do recognize that a utility pole creates inconvenience when placed on tillable ground. However, Minn Kota's selection of the steel monopole helps minimize this impact by allowing installation of the poles without any guy wires, which helps minimize the overall footprint for the project. In addition, the steel monopole supports a 1,000-foot spacing between poles that helps to eliminate this impact as well. Yeah, farm equipment will need to move around the physical structures for seeding or harvest, but again, with 1,000-foot spacing, this approximates about 5 structures per mile, also helping to minimize that impact. We also recognize that the new line may create some issues with aerial applicators, but we feel that they can still use the aerial application. They just may need to modify their approach or fly parallel with the line while spraying the field.
What compensation will landowners receive for disruption of land use during construction?
And besides the permanent easement, Minn Kota also arranges for temporary construction easement if it's required. If access along the right-of-way isn't available, we may need to widen our construction area, and we would obtain a temporary construction easement for that. We also make crop payments if there's any crop damage during the construction. These payments are based on the first year's crop loss, and then we pay subsequent payments for the next 2 or 3 years after the project. We also pay land damage payments if we do rutting or some compaction on prairie land or non-crop land, that we will restore that land and also pay land damages as well for that. And we also pay for reconstruction of fencing that may need to be temporarily constructed or gates installed during the construction phase.
And what are some of the benefits of the project?
Primary benefits are this access to increased base load generation to accommodate our future demand and load growth needs, and also the additional grid reliability that this line provides that Mr. Bartel testified to. There's also some long-term state and local tax payments that help fund community needs. These payments go to school districts and fire districts. And we also have the jobs and construction during the construction phase. We anticipate approximately 200 to 250 specialized construction personnel for the foundation construction and line construction and various other activities. And approximately 40 to 60 of these positions should be local hire positions with opportunity that include local concrete supply and batch plant work, civil work for road construction and maintenance, the tree clearing crews, and the fence construction and gate installation. And also, local labor may be used for specialized for traffic control and the land restoration after construction. So other construction stimulus to the local economies include expenditures for product and services, including the hotels and restaurant trades.
And based on the studies and analyses conducted and on the testimony that you've presented today, what are some of the conclusions that Minn Kota has reached with respect to the proposed project?
We feel that this project is the best possible solution for delivering the additional baseload generation to Minn Kota's service territory and also improving the reliability of the region's electrical network by solving a known voltage stability issue in the northern Red River Valley. Through the required federal review process, which did include the in-depth environmental review and numerous opportunities for stakeholder and public input, Minn Kota has developed a viable 1,000-foot wide corridor. We believe this proposed corridor meets all of North Dakota's siting requirements and will result in the least overall impact of the alternatives considered. In addition to providing this additional baseload generation and grid reliability, the project will bring long-term economic benefits through state and local tax payments and short-term stimulus through the construction jobs and related expenditures.
I have no further questions.
Mr. Sagsveen.
In your permit application, is there a FONSI, or was there a FONSI issued, a finding of no significant impact, or has that conclusion been reached yet?
That process is still ongoing. The environmental assessment with scoping is complete. There's two other parallel paths that are also being worked on that need to come to completion before the FONSI will be issued. The first path that's being looked at is the with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, the Section 7 consideration, the Endangered Species Act. We're still ongoing discussions with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service on the whooping crane marking of the new line and their requirement for marking equivalent on existing lines. So that's an ongoing discussion. The other parallel path for the FONSI is the consideration for the Section 106, the cultural and historical. We're working through the details of our programmatic agreement, and that should be come to conclusion within the 60 to 90 days as well. So our FONSI is about 60 to 90 days out from being completed.
Mr. Sagsveen, I suspect there's some members of the public who have no idea what a FONSI is.
Thank you, Judge. I was going to elaborate a little bit. A FONSI is, in I guess, federal terminology, a finding of no significant impact. And it's part of the National Environmental Protection Act.
Policy Act.
I'm sorry. It's the federal program to protect the environment that's been in place, I think, since 1976 for quite a while. And there'll be a process where a federal agency will take a preliminary review of a project, and if they determine that there is no significant impact, they'll issue a FONSI. And if there is a significant impact, they will do, I believe, an EIS to conduct a further environmental impact on the project. And so to follow up on my question, thank you, Judge, the proposed routes in 7 and 8, are you telling me that it's possible that those might change? Or when I say 7 and 8, I mean Exhibits 7 and 8. Through the EA process or maybe after an EIS?
No, what we're saying is the preliminary review from the RUS, which is the federal agency overseeing the NEPA process, is that they agree with the concurrence of the environmental assessment that the route shown in Exhibit 8, which is identified as Route A in the environmental assessment, is the preferred route for the project.
Okay, so even though the environmental assessment hasn't been finished, everyone's agreed that that's the preferred route to work on.
That's correct.
And that being the red, I don't know, in 7, it's, I think, Route A and Exhibit 8, the red, it's also red and it's also Route A?
It's just identified as the proposed corridor in Exhibit 8. It transitions from a route in the environmental analysis as one of the considered routes to the proposed corridor for the state process. That's where we're doing that crossover between the federal process and the state process.
Okay, so that's my next question. In Exhibit 8, you use the word route, and Exhibit 7, the word route is used. In Exhibit 8, the word corridor is used. So, for the purposes of the federal review, are they reviewing the 1,000-foot corridor or the 100-foot wide route?
The federal review reviews the 1,000-foot wide route in their terminology. So.
Okay, so their route is our corridor.
That's correct. It's confusing. I know we, as a project team, we intermix route and corridor, but. I think the correct way to think of it is the corridor is always the wider, and in the state process, we're proposing the 1,000-foot corridor for the corridor compatibility application, and the route permit will be the narrower 150-foot wide right-of-way that will actually be submitted in that application.
I don't think I have any further questions.
Mr. Lean?
Yeah, Mike, I missed, did you say, did you give us a percentage of what kind of options you've got issued? So is it 80% issued or for easements, or?
Currently, we have 57% of the easements, or the landowners have signed options for easements along this corridor.
Okay. And you were talking a little bit about a payment being a one-time upfront payment. And they do get an option if they want to take that payment amount in annual installments, right?
That's correct. We can pay annual installments over 5 years if in lieu of the one-time payment.
Okay, thanks.
I would like to make one correction. I said 57% of the landowners. That's 50% of the 57% of the miles of the line are under option, not landowners.
Okay, no further questions. Thank you.
Follow up, Mr. Sagsbean.
Thank you, Your Honor. I just had one further question. Is the permit application that Minn Kota has provided complete, and can the Public Service Commission base its decision on the corridor application without any additional supplementation, or do you envision that you will be supplementing the record to include additional materials?
It is complete to my knowledge. Your decision can be based on our submittals to date.
No further questions.
Commissioner Kramer.
Thank you. Michael, you've outlined in your application a pretty aggressive timeline, given that you're at 57% of the miles have options. How do you see landowner easement option relations to this point? In other words, how optimistic are you that the other 43% can be done rather quickly, which you would be required in order to meet your timeline?
Yes, this is a challenge, and we break them up into, you know, categories of options signed, options actively being negotiated, and options denied.
Sure.
So right now we're sitting at roughly 16 to 17% that are denied. So we still have a large out there that are waiting for the outcome of this hearing to help them make a decision as to the acceptance of our offer. So our goal is to have 80% of the options by the route permit hearings, and then secure the rest prior to construction.
Okay, thank you. Just a little bit on the question in direct, and then Jerry's clarification, I guess, about the one-time payment being paid out over 5 years, if you'd like. And you referred to no other transmission project in the region. Are there transmission projects in other parts of the country that do, in fact, have annual landowner payments? And I think in direct, it was alluded to the fact that wind turbine easements have certainly changed the perspective of a lot of people. And so if you could just, first of all, are there other parts of the country where it's more common, or at least?
Not to my knowledge.
Okay.
Yeah. We do, just one clarification,
sure,
that we do make a distinction between transmission lines associated with wind farms, and generally being a generation outlet line. We do know that one utility in recent history offered annual payments, but none of the landowners accepted the annual payments for that project.
Okay, I understand. If you have annual payments, tax payments, as you referred, I mean, would it be out of the realm of possibility, do you think, even this project aside, into the future? Because this is a discussion that's taking place in a lot of organizations right now. Can you see it like a tax ever getting to that point where it would be an annual payment? And what would the impact of that be on, perhaps to the bottom line, electricity prices that we in North Dakota enjoy to this point, some low ones?
We can only see that adding, cost to the overall, delivery of electricity to manage, that payment structure.
All right. One other question, specifically about the Grand Forks airport.
Okay.
We talked about aerial applicators and the impacts on that, and that's, you know, minimal and still can be done with greater care, no doubt, with all the appropriate markings. But is there a specific or special interest, given that the Grand Forks Airport is an extremely busy airport, and that it is also a laboratory, if you will, for student pilots? Does that, have special concerns been raised about that?
Yes, they have. We're definitely working with the FAA on our proposed corridor, you know, does path to the south of the Grand Forks a major approachway. There is existing transmission lines there that kind of set the threshold, and our design challenge is to meet that height restriction across that corridor to not impact the glide slope, you know, because of the heavy use of that airport. So that is definitely a design challenge for us to cross east and west across that southern flight path.
Very good. Thank you. I have nothing further, Your Honor.
Commissioner Cook.
Thank you, Your Honor. Thanks for your testimony, Mike. I actually have a lot of questions, if you just bear with me for a while.
Sure.
Going back to, I guess, Exhibit 4, when we kind of start with the beginning methodology, it looks like that basically because of the quote-unquote environmental concerns, that southern route was basically just dropped pretty quickly. Is that right?
That's correct. The high percentage of wetlands and the larger wetlands, you know, our span is 1,000 foot, so challenges for, you know, crossing a larger wetland body presented an engineering challenge as well.
Okay, let me go back and give you, I guess, some of my bias is that, you know, I did 20 years in the Marine Corps, and there was a couple years in there I worked with the NEPA projects, with the project that we would build, and I often found that the NEPA would guide our decision away for where we thought was the best place to go, because they would make it, there would be threats, if you will, of, well, you can't build here because of this, this, and this. But later I found that you can mitigate anything. So how did you balance that of, okay, you could have built it there or proposed it, but there probably would have been a whole bunch of mitigation. Did you walk that through at all?
And that was considered, you know, as the factors in an environmental review, you know, in the study corridor selection process. And yes, the impact is there. You know, you have to use matting during construction, you know, so the cost during construction, and again, the number of poles, the you know, the spanning of the larger, you know, requires a taller pole. Because of the large number of migratory bird, you know, production, you know, habitat area in that area, you know, having additional, you know, taller structures and spanning the wetlands. So that, you know, we do have wetlands across the whole, you know, project. So it's just one alternative to help, you know, minimize the wetland impact to the project was to, you know, select areas that, being we have to deal with the whole project to select a corridor, that wouldn't be the primary, you know, concern for that whole corridor selection.
Okay, so then maybe kind of a follow-up to that is that, let's see here, Exhibit 7 lays out all the different proposed routes, if you will, correct?
That's correct.
Okay, is there somewhere in the filings that you've given us that kind of gives almost like a matrix of why routes B and C were dropped from moving them forward? So you could easily look at it and say, okay, route B, as you went down the line, this, this, and this were reasons that no longer made that viable. And the same thing for route C. Some were easily to look at, not so much for me today, but as we go back and review this.
Right, that is included in the environmental analysis, is included as a exhibit to the corridor application. And specifically, I'd direct your attention to table 4.0.1 within that does summarize that route analysis. You know, the text goes through each in detail, but this table does summarize and help, you know, clarify our decision process for selecting route A.
Okay. Let's see here. What else did I have? You talked about the construction schedule, and I think Kevin hit on this a little bit. But, you know, we are in a wet cycle. That's all there's to it. And so how much have you adjusted that construction schedule based on the last 2 years, which I would anticipate the next 2 years not to be much drier than the last two?
Well, we are anticipating having to do some construction in the winter. to meet some of the environmental concerns for crossing the Missouri River, some of the species there. We're asked to avoid construction during the nesting season there, so that puts us into winter construction. So, and some of the wetland mitigation would also require winter construction. So we're not planning such a tight construction schedule that we're forced to work in that time frame, but we certainly recognize that we have to work in that time frame. So we may need winter construction to minimize the impact because of the wet cycle that we're in. So again, that gets back to that question of why are you allowing 2 years, to complete this line, and that's to give that flexibility.
Okay. And I guess I won't say the last, but maybe the next question is Exhibit 9 laid out a very good matrix of the public participation and then the regulatory process, and I think this is a requirement under NEPA to do these kind of things, to almost have this as a good cheat sheet to show what you did. But I'm not saying that your proposed route is not a good idea at this point, it's premature, but I do have a concern that you've got a NEPA process that you've worked very aggressively and you've done the things that you need to do, and the NEPA process is all based around what you have right now. Well, what if we deem this is not right? Then what happens to the NEPA process? How far back does that put you? Has the commission been pushed away because of NEPA without us giving a chance to ask these questions today?
That does put challenges on that process. I mean, we have, the macro corridor study as part of the NEPA process to fall back on. So as long as we're within that macro corridor study, then we feel that we would have to file a slight amendment. So if the route changes from the route A or the corridor in our application dramatically, we would have to amend our application with the RUS and do some additional analysis. Yes,
sure.
That's correct.
That's why I think I asked the question about, give me the matrix, if you will, of why those other routes didn't move forward, because I think that gives us some of the answers to the question I was talking about. Did you ever consider a hybrid route, if you will, looking back at Exhibit 7, to where you may jump back and forth between different routes? Or were they all, unique, if you will?
Well, I think if you look back at Exhibit 6, those are all the route segments that we started at, and we took each segment as an individual component, and we did the analysis on the impact. Again, amount of wetlands, amount of wooded areas, amount of cropland, amount of prairie land, and other considerations.
So at this point, you didn't have any particular A, B, C, or anything. You just, I understand that.
Right. So then we took those route segments and then assembled them into two routes that we felt would meet the North Dakota PSC criteria. So that was the driver for taking these route segments and assembling them into overall routes.
Okay, perfect. And just and I know I can review this, but in your experience and what you've gone through, that southernmost route that basically runs, I think that'd be C, what was the major disqualifying factor for that one, if you will?
There was three reasons for that southern route being disqualified. I mean, initially, we like the Highway 200 corridor concept.
Yep.
But if you look at the impact to homeowners along that, homeowners tend to build alongside the highway corridors. So the impact is you're coming along, and then you might have to cross the road to miss one house. And if there's one on that side, then you have to go around the house. So you tend to box in properties by following major highway corridors versus going a mile or two off the corridor onto section lines and quarter section lines. You minimize the impact. So that was a primary driver. Also, the amount of irrigated land in that corridor is considerably higher than the northern corridor as well.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Ms. Smith, follow-up?
I think, one question. When we're talking about the environmental assessment, as a clarification, the environmental assessment has been finalized. Is that correct?
The environmental assessment has been finalized, but the RUS, as the agency, has not issued their FONSI, waiting for the Section 7 and the Section 106 processes to complete. So the three components have to come together for them to issue the FONSI.
Okay. And so out of the environmental assessment, when they selected that preferred route, that is the final selection?
That's correct.
I have no further questions.
Mr. Sagsveen?
No further questions.
Mr. Leon?
No questions.
Question, follow-up from the commission? All right. Let's be in recess for lunch. Now, hopefully, I understand there's at least one restaurant and the flower shop. I'm not sure what the flower shop is, but at any event, I would hope we can do lunch in 45, 50 minutes. So let's be back here at 1:15, please, 1:15. Now, let me also say that I do not propose to go to lunch. I'll be glad to talk with anyone who would like to talk to me about their public testimony, if they're considering that or have specific questions. I'll be glad to do that now or later, and in the meantime, if there's nobody to talk to me, I have a newspaper to read, so I'm in good shape. And we'll see you all back at 1:15, please.